Hi, look over here. Hi, I'm Hunter Rawlings, the outgoing president of Cornell, where I'm also professor of classics.
And I'm Jeff Rustin of Cornell's classics department. I'm glad we found such a suitable location to introduce you to Sophocles' play, Antigone.
The Antigone of Sophocles is a play that was originally produced in 440 BC in the open air in the city of Athens. And I think it's always important to remember that what we have as a text was meant to be a major production, outdoors with a large audience and in a festival atmosphere, because the Athenians produced their plays in the midst of festivals that ran for several days and that created an atmosphere of participation by large numbers of people who went to the theater together as part of a public performance. The Antigone is a play that is fraught with tension between opposing forces. There are the opposing forces of Creon, the king, and Antigone, his niece. There is the force of the city or polis versus that of the family and its demands. There's also the force of the civic life of the individual versus the religious life of the individual. During the course of the play, these opposing forces intensify to a point of almost excruciating opposition. And the ancient audience must have been severely affected by the tension that developed during the course of the play. And that is what produces the tragic outcome. And that tragic outcome is something that I think the Greeks would not have seen in the same way we typically do. We're affected by tragedy, of course, just as they were. But it was a very deep-seated Greek belief that tragedy produces learning. That is, learning comes through suffering. And at the end of the play, I think, though we have been confronted with terrible tragedies, we also have learned something, as the chorus makes clear in the last lines of the play. Wisdom is by far the greatest part of joy, and reverence toward the gods must be safeguarded. The mighty words of the proud are paid in full with mighty blows of fate. And at long last, those blows will teach us wisdom. That's a hard lesson, a very hard lesson indeed. And it is a rare individual who can go through a play like this and feel in any sense uplifted. On the other hand, it is through very deep suffering that one can come to the kind of deep wisdom that Sophocles, I think, intended for his audience to gain as a result of seeing this play. As the Antigone develops, it becomes quite clear that the major opposing forces in the play are Creon and Antigone, the king and his niece. And it's tempting, as with any pair of opposites, to choose one or the other, to come to the conclusion that Creon, for example, is completely wrong and Antigone is completely right. I would urge you to resist that tendency to take sides or to come to a superficial conclusion that one of these figures is completely right and the other one is completely wrong. Sophocles, I think, should be given credit for having created an opposition here in which it's difficult to take sides, in which it is important, I think, to recognize what is strong and powerful about the arguments of both figures, because they each have something to tell us.
It's not even entirely clear who the main character of the story is. Obviously, it's named after Antigone, and her point of view is endorsed at the end. But Creon is the constant focus of our action in the play. He's the victim of the story in many ways, and he's on stage most of the time. From an actor's point of view, his is the better part. Each of these two characters has a very eloquent and seemingly unanswerable speech of defense. Creon quite reasonably maintains that without obedience, the state is doomed to anarchy, and his decrees must be followed to save the lives of the citizens. Antigone, on the other hand, asserts that there are unwritten laws more important than the decrees of the state that overmatch anything a mere mortal king can decree. These characters also have their less attractive sides, though, and they say some things that are not at all idealistic. Creon can be paranoid. He can also be extremely misogynistic, and he sometimes tries to rule through fear and intimidation. Antigone, even, though idealistic, is in fact the last proud remnant of a noble family, a family that Creon is trying to wipe out because it's been so damaging to Thebes. Creon is a responsible king, and his decree, as he says, is motivated by the good of his city after a bloody civil war. But little by little throughout the play, he reveals that he has a less attractive side, and that he's motivated by the desire to keep and obtain power. The ancient references to the public reaction to this play are somewhat disturbing. One of them is that the poet Sophocles was elected a general on the basis of public acclaim for this play. It seems highly unlikely that he was elected a general because of the public's recognition of Antigone, much more likely that they adored Creon. And the one quotation we have of the play from the 4th century by the orator Demosthenes says the greatest speech in the play, which he quotes, is that of Creon against anarchy. The figure of Antigone, an outspoken, politically engaged young woman, seems very modern, but in ancient Athens, she was extremely novel conception. To say that women were not an important force in the theater or important in public life would be a ridiculous understatement. The audience that saw Antigone performed was made entirely of men. The author who penned the play was a man, and the actors who played her as well as the other parts were all males. The play was not realistic in that sense. In Athenian public law, women were not even considered legal or moral agents. The crime that Antigone supposedly committed, she could not have been prosecuted for. Her husband or her father would have had to be prosecuted for it instead. So we can see that the Athenian conception of Antigone involves a leap of the imagination to place a good woman in a society of all male dominance and make her the heroine of the play. It's more frequent that the women are middle-aged and wicked in tragedy, like Clytemnestra or Medea. The original ancient Athenian performance is one with masks, chorus dancing, and musical accompaniment. Those elements are all gone beyond recall now. We can't attempt to reconstruct them. But we can try to visualize while we read, especially the effect of these formal constraints on a play that seems so modern and so character-based. That's why it's fascinating that David Felcher has taken on the project not of reconstructing an original performance, but of exploring and interpreting the possibilities of its original form.